Hold your thoughts. Save your questions for the very end of the seminar. When he's done, he will open up for question and answer. Do you have something?
Okay, say, I think a bunch of you might not have response cards. It might be worth shooting during the event so they get right questions.
If you don't, does anyone want a response card, right? Does anyone need a response card right now? So like I said, we're going to save our question and answer portion for after the seminar. So here he is, Professor John Oakes with God and Science, Friend or Foe.
Thanks. It's good to be back here. 1977, that was a long time ago. That was, as we say in Christianity, B.C., you know, before Christ. How many of you have climbed to the top of the radio tower? Marty, did I take you up there, Marty? Yeah, all right, yeah. We made a little bit of trouble back then. Yeah. By the way, my friend Marty, we're dorm mates from the last time we saw each other, I think was about 39 or 40 years ago. And so we're good friends from back then. So anyway, let me give you a little bit of my background. I grew up going to church. I was it was a traditional denomination, the guy who carried the cross and all that kind of stuff. And I was the president of the church youth group. A little problem with that is I didn't believe in God. I was an atheist. I don't know how that worked. You know, that seems a little odd. And I remember coming to UConn, and maybe Marty can remember, Josh McDowell came to campus, and there was the Christian guy in the dorm we shared, and we were laughing at this guy. And I remember taking philosophy as a freshman, and we were studying about Nietzsche. Nietzsche said, God is dead. I was like, yeah, that's awesome. And actually, Nietzsche's dead now, and God seems to be doing okay. But anyway, through studying science in college, I came to believe in God. And I didn't necessarily assume Christianity. In fact, I was into Eastern religion and Buddhism and Hinduism. But through studying science, I came to believe in God. So what I'm going to do tonight is I'm just going to mention a few reasons why I, as a scientist, feel it's reasonable to believe in God. That'll be the first half of the talk. And then the second half of the talk, I'll talk a little bit about, well, then why the Bible, even from a scientific perspective. All right? So we're going to consider two possible perspectives. One would be represented by Thomas Huxley, who was good friends with Charles Darwin. He's called Darwin's Bulldog. And he said, we're as much the product of blind forces as is the falling of the stone to earth or the ebb and flow of tides. We just happen. And man was made flesh by a series of singularly beneficial accidents. So one perspective is, there's no purpose, no reason, no design. We just are. We just exist. Mm-hmm. Chemicals bumped into other chemicals, and here we are. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's one perspective. That's the atheist perspective. Another, more recent, not definitely more recent, advocate of this view would be Richard Dawkins, who said, in the universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, others are going to get lucky. You won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we'd expect if there's at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. It just is, and we dance to its music. And these guys represent the perspective that I used to have, the atheist perspective. Now, if that's true, it's awfully depressing. All right, but that's the perspective. Now, so one perspective is we can explain everything by blind chance, accident, luck. There's no design, no design. Another perspective would be that represented by the illustration of our friend William Paley, who first made the watchmaker argument. Yeah, the idea of design and design showing God. Now, I'm not going to use the watchmaker argument because that's kind of old-fashioned. We're going to have the cell phone argument. Hey. The cell phone argument. Ooh. So imagine, you know, you'll get it back later. Imagine. What's wrong with that?
That's an iPhone 4.
Let's imagine you're walking down the street, you see that thing sitting there on the ground, all right? You're thinking, all right, how'd that get there? Well, you know, blind
you know, forces. You know, maybe some metal, some plastic, a car went over there, people kicked it. I'm not going to kick it. Kicked it around. Boom! Cell phone.
That's crazy.
Right? Because obviously designed. Now, which has more design features to it? The simplest conceivable living thing or this cell phone? And the simplest living thing has much more design than this thing. And yet there are people who confidently proclaim, as Dawkins did, that it's just accident. Just random events. All right? I want to challenge that. In fact, to me, a better illustration than the pocket watch or the cell phone might be this. Imagine you got a junkyard full of wood, metal, clay, brick, dirt, plastic, glass. And then a tornado runs through there, and out pops a 747, you know? I mean, some people actually believe that, that information can come from non-information, and that's the atheist perspective. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to spend, just look at a few things that I teach in just a standard introductory chemistry or physics class that tells me design, designer, and God. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about water. I'm a chemistry professor, and you could teach an entire one semester course just to explain all the properties unique to water that no other molecule has. And for every single one of those properties, if water didn't have those properties, there'd be no life. All right? Design or accident? I'll just mention a few. For example, in order for life to exist, there needs to be a liquid to act as a solvent. Solid doesn't do, gas doesn't do. You need a liquid to act as a solvent. And it would have to be a liquid in a fairly narrow temperature range. Chemists would tell you that below around minus 20 centigrade, there's not enough energy for chemical reactions to be initiated. And above about 80 degrees centigrade, the molecules that could form life would fall apart. So you have to have a substance that's liquid somewhere in that range, but not the whole range, as we'll see for some other reasons. Now, that liquid would have to be able to dissolve a wide range of substances. Now, guess what liquid dissolves a wider range of substances than any other?
Water,
of course. In fact, in order for life to exist, that liquid that is the substance within which life can exist would have to be able to dissolve ions, like sodium ion and chloride. Otherwise, you don't have a nervous system, you don't have communication. And guess how many substances that are liquid and in the correct temperature range are able to dissolve ions. Exactly one. So many other properties of water. Another property of water is that of all the substances in the universe, it absorbs the most heat. I was just teaching this just Thursday in my physical science class talking about that. And all other substances absorb 1/10 as much heat or less, or 1/8 as much heat. Water absorbs far more heat than any other substance in the universe. All right? Just accident, luck. The same molecule that has the right solvent properties, the right boiling properties, also happens to absorb the most heat. Why is that important? Well, if water was like any other substance, the temperature of the Earth would go up and down 150 to 200 degrees centigrade in any given year, and obviously there'd be no water. I could talk about the viscosity of water. Now, water has another property that's very interesting. Now, generally, the solid sinks and the liquid flows. Guess how many exceptions there are? Exactly one. And that's water. Why is that important? Well, because when it gets cold enough for water to freeze, and by the way, the freezing of water acts as a buffer to protect the Earth's temperature from swinging too wildly. And so in the winter, what would happen is the lakes would freeze right to the bottom. Say, well, okay, fine. I guess so what if it kills all the fish? But during ice ages, the oceans would freeze to the bottom. And again, no life. I could talk about the viscosity of water, which is perfect. And I could go on and on and on. But I say to a good job, God, for inventing water. And again, I'm just beginning to even mention some of the properties of water. Now, some of you probably are getting, you know, cold sweats right now. Obviously, I teach chemistry, and I tell my students that this chart, these things don't show up on these business card things. That's weird.
See, it shows up there, shows up there, and shows up there.
Oh, so I just have to point. Does that still work? Just the old-fashioned pointer? All right. Now, I teach my students that that chart was invented by a guy, a Russian chemist named Mendeleev.
I guess it's true historically, but actually, guess who invented that chart? God invented that chart. His fingerprints are all over that chart. There are at least 22 elements that I know of that have a property that no other element has, and if that element didn't have that property, there'd be no life. Now, one argument is, it's just blind fatalism, it's just accident. Another argument is design and God. And again, like I said, in studying science, I came to the conclusion there has to be a God. Now, a lot of people kind of try to put out this impression, believing in God, that's for people who need a crutch, or, that's like old-fashioned fable, but now that we have modern things, we don't need that stuff anymore. And obviously intelligent people would believe in God, because that's for people who are less educated or something like that. And I want to say to that is utter nonsense. All right, so let me share some examples. Do we have any people studying a little chemistry here? All right, what's the first element I'm going to mention that has so much design? Somebody said carbon. Oh, I heard carbon. Did you say carbon? Good job, all right? Let's talk about carbon. Sorry. Didn't you say hydrogen? Did you say hydrogen? All right, that's not in my outline, but I'm going to mention hydrogen. Because hydrogen is the only element which can fuse spontaneously to form energy. Right? And if hydrogen didn't have that property, we obviously wouldn't be here. So that's a pretty cool thing right there. But carbon, I teach organic chemistry, and I spend the first week just explaining all the properties unique to carbon that no other element has. And it just so happens, every single one of those properties, if carbon didn't have those properties, there'd be no life. To me, that says something. One of the properties of carbon is that it forms four bonds. Actually, it's not the only element that forms four bonds. Also, silicon forms four bonds. Now, do we have any Star Trek fans here? I've got a couple of them. Right? Now, Marty and I are so old, we remember watching the original Star Trek when it was on in the 60s. Right? No, don't tell me you remember.
No, I honestly watch it.
I know, but you don't remember the original. Wait a minute.
One of the episodes, Spock is there with Kirk, and there's this bubbling sort of creature in the corner, and Spock takes his tricorder and says, "Oh, very logical, silicon creature." And the reason for that is, turns out there's actually two elements that form four bonds. That's carbon and silicon. But the problem with silicon is, if you have two silicon atoms together in a molecule, that molecule explodes. Now, why is that important? Because without four...
it's not important that it explodes, but why is it important that it has four bonds?
Because without four bonds, the molecule can't be three-dimensional. And if you don't have three-dimensional molecules, you don't have three-dimensional life. So that seems pretty important. Another property of carbon that's worth mentioning is it's the only element that allows one to form large molecules. Yep. And without large molecules, again, you're not going to have life. You form single, double, triple bonds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to skip all that. I'll get to our next element. Actually, let me go back. Another element that has absolutely essential properties is iron. It's completely essential because iron is the only element that forms a strong magnetic field. And of course that's important, because how else could you put your kid's homework on the refrigerator? No, that's not why. Now, again, getting back to the hydrogen, that hydrogen with its totally unique properties, that's on the left, the sun, that's an amazing design. It creates energy, and almost all the energy that comes from the sun is in the visible part of the spectrum. Lucky for us. Because visible light is the only kind of light that can initiate chemical reactions without destroying molecules. Now, but there are two kinds of radiation that come from the sun, both of which would destroy all life on the earth, except God had another plan to take care of that. Right? And one of those, of course, is the charged particles, the solar wind. And the magnetic field of the earth is literally a force field that bends those ions around the earth, otherwise life would be wiped out. Now, there's another fact about iron that's really cool.
Because not only is iron the only magnetic element, from the nuclear perspective, it's also the most stable element. So, guess what element the Earth is made out of mostly?
Iron.
So, not only is it the only magnetic element, it's also the most stable element. And if it weren't for both facts being the same element, there'd be no life on the Earth. Accident or intelligence behind that? The conclusion seems fairly obvious to me. And then there's oxygen. There are two forms of oxygen. One form of oxygen, without that form, we couldn't have high metabolism living things. The other form, though, ozone, prevents the other kind of dangerous radiation from hitting the Earth, which is ultraviolet. Let me see, one more. There's so many I could do. I'll just do one more. Uranium. Now, you probably think uranium is dangerous. And by the way, I just taught about this in my other chemistry class a couple days ago. It's sort of cool timing here. All right, because we talked about uranium being radioactive and having a half-life. Now, you probably think uranium is dangerous, right? It is. Because it's radioactive. But if uranium was not radioactive, we wouldn't be here. It's essential. Because if it were not for the energy released by uranium, and by the way, uranium is very, very dense. So guess where almost all of it is? Inside of the Earth, lucky for us. But the energy released from the uranium, which has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, allows the Earth to still be hot in the middle. If it were not for that, you'd have no plate tectonics. And plate tectonics is a massive recycling system that returns minerals to the surface so life can be sustained. And without plate tectonics, we'd have no atmosphere.
Yep.
So if you don't want to have plate tectonics, fine, go to Mars. No atmosphere, sterile surface. And by the way, I'm just scratching the surface. Everywhere you look, you uncover further evidence that makes the atheist positions border on irrational. All right, let me see here. Oh, yeah, DNA.
Yes.
Now, it's kind of geeky, but I will get kind of chills when I think about DNA. It's so amazing. It is truly an amazing design. All right, it's got the A, the G, the C, and the T. Those are the nucleotides, and those nucleotides form a code. And the code determines the amino acids to form the proteins. Now, let me ask you a question here. Common sense question. Could a code emerge by random molecules bumping into one another? Does that make any sense? And yet there's people who actually believe it. And you have to ask yourself, why do they believe that? Well, I'm gonna mention a verse. This is not a Bible lesson, but I'm gonna mention a verse in Romans that might possibly help explain why that would be. So anyway, just to give you a feeling for this. Human DNA has about 3 billion of those A, G's, C's, and T's. That's a lot of information. Mm-hmm. All right, that's the amount of information in a small library. Now, we have to imagine how the first life came to exist. Because like Dawkins and others said, you know, blind, pitiless, and, you know, forces and all these kinds of things. But let's not use the human as a model, because clearly we have a lot more information than the simplest life. How about bacteria with 100 million base pairs? Let's cut it in half, 50 million base pairs. Let's cut it in half, again, 25 million base pairs. How much information is that? That's the amount of information in 2 or 3 novels. So the chances of these nucleotides coming together in a means that has information that makes sense that could be read to create life would be like taking 25 million letters, throwing them in the air, and when they land on the ground, you could read them and it would make sense. Right, you got the point.
Yeah.
And so atheists say, well, that's what happened. And I say, well, why do you believe that's what happened? Because it's what happened. That's not a very good argument. It's not a very good argument at all. It's called circular reasoning. Now let me explain one more sort of layer of why this is truly difficult to believe. In fact, I don't know how atheists do it. I mean, seriously. The amount of faith they have, it boggles my mind. As a Christian, I struggle in my faith sometimes. All of us do. But I'm telling you, to have a sufficient faith to hold on to this idea that it all came about by random things with no design at all, it takes a level of faith. I seriously wonder sometimes. Now, here's the deal. The only thing in the universe that makes proteins is DNA. But the only thing in the universe that makes DNA is proteins. So here's what the atheist believes, is that simultaneously, the DNA that would have made the proteins but didn't appear in the same place that the proteins that would have made the same DNA but didn't. Now, that's sort of confusing, right? But do you get the idea?
That's,
thank you, the chicken and the egg. The chicken and the egg, that's easy.
Chicken came first.
Which came first, the DNA or the protein? There is no logical answer. They came up with the RNA explanation, and I'm telling you, RNA is not an explanation. It's an excuse. Trust me from knowing about RNA. Okay. Now, nature creates order. This is a natural creation with a lot of order. Nature creates order spontaneously. What nature never creates is information spontaneously. Information only can be created by information. In every attempt by scientists to create a model that would allow this information to be spontaneously generated, they all fall apart. They have to put in tons and tons of information. And the bottom line is, the idea that life came about by random processes is, I believe, is actually absurd, based on the information we have. All right, I'm going to skip a few slides. Here we go. Let's talk about physics a little bit. I'm also a physics professor.
I know, in my spare time, is what I do.
Nothing better to do. All right. Now, before the 1950s, all along, the Bible said the universe was created from nothing. Hebrews 11:3 says, by faith we know that the things that are seen were made from things that are unseen.
Right.
All right, and, you know, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So the Bible said all along, the universe was created literally from nothing, physically from nothing. Physicists radically disagree with that until the 1950s. They believed the universe had always existed. Now, why do physicists believe the universe had always existed? Is it because the evidence pointed in that direction? No. Well, why do they believe that? Because the alternative is disturbing to the atheist position, which is the universe was created. All right, but then in the early 20s, Hubble discovered that the universe is expanding very rapidly, and then physicists came up with a theory to explain that away, and then they discovered the background radiation, all this other stuff you don't need to know about. The bottom line is, physicists came to the unavoidable conclusion that the universe began in a brilliant flash of light from nothing. And before this happened, not only was there no matter or energy, not even space or time. The entire universe came into existence literally from nothing. Yeah. So physicists got caught up with the Bible finally in about the 50s or 60s. But their resistance to this idea was rather strong, to say the least. All right, now let's talk a little bit about the parameters of the universe. The universe has been described as a finely tuned. Right? Now, would you agree that that's a small number?
Yes.
Very small number.
Very small number.
To illustrate the size of that number, do they have the lottery in Connecticut? That
yes.
They do.
Yes.
Okay. Well, they didn't have it when I lived here. That's how long ago I lived here. Okay. Now, imagine your friend won the super lotto. What would you say? You say, wait, bro, what are you gambling for? It's not a sin to buy one. It's okay. But anyway, now what if your friend won the super lotto again the next week? What if he won the super lotto 6 consecutive weeks? All right, this number represents the probability of winning super lotto something like 6 or 7 times in a row. And in mathematics, beyond 50 zeros, they just basically say it's officially zero. Zero. It does not happen. It will not happen. It cannot happen. Now, it turns out, in modeling the Big Bang and trying to describe the physics of it, they notice an astounding fact, which is, as the universe expanded, gravity caused that matter to clump. And it turns out, if gravity was bigger than what it is, by that fraction, the universe would have collapsed almost as soon as it was created. On the other hand, if gravity had been smaller than it is, by that same fraction, the universe would have expanded forever, stars and galaxies would not have formed. So what's the probability that the atheist is right about this?
That number.
That it's just an accident. Because if the universe was a random creation without any intent or any design, and how that creation would happen at all anyway is hard to imagine, because why does anything exist? Can the atheist explain why anything exists? No, they can't. You know, I was watching a BBC show a couple years ago, and this atheist guy was up there. It was kind of like intellects on trial. So they had the theist and the atheist on there. And they asked the atheist guy, he's a chemist, they said, you know, give us your position. He said, the only things that are real are things that can be observed and measured through science. And they said to him, well, how do you know that? He said, well, these religious people, blah, 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 fundamentalists, blah, blah, blah. That wasn't much of an answer, was it? They said, excuse me, we asked you a question. How do you know? The only things that are real are things that can be measured and observed by your science. Blah, 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 you know, these Muslims and these Christians and these people and blah, blah, blah. And they said, excuse me, sir, we ask the questions, you give the answers. If you're not going to answer your question, we'll just bring the next person on. And he said, I guess I just believe it. All right? That was his answer. That was his argument. That was his evidence. All right. Anyway, it turns out that there are at least 25 parameters. Virtually every parameter that defines how the universe works has this kind of property. That if you change it even a small amount, we wouldn't be here to observe it. Okay? For example, the nuclear strong force, which holds the protons and neutrons together. Just a few percent bigger, and there'd be no hydrogen, therefore no stars, and it wouldn't be in big trouble. Just a few percent smaller, and to be only hydrogen, also that'd be problematic. We can talk about the nuclear weak force, the electric force, all these other things. By the way, number six on the list, that's the one that I talked about first. The number six on the list is the one that has 59 zeros and a one. All right. So at some point, if you start to add all these things together, it becomes seriously irrational, in my opinion, to hold on to this view of atheism. All right? So the universe is like a finely tuned instrument. And when I was doing my research, we had to all these different things, we had to all these parameters, we had to match to get that ion beam and the laser beam to overlap, and it took us something like a year to get it working. And we're talking about plus or minus 1% on five different things, and that was pretty tough. All right, Fred Hoyle said, a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as chemistry and biology. And by the way, I didn't even start talking about biology yet. Probably because I'm not a biologist, okay? I'm not talk about it. Okay? I'm going to skip a whole bunch of slides. So many other examples. Let me talk a little bit about science and Christianity. I'm going to spend a little bit less time on that. I want to have lots of time for question and answer. So my conclusion from the first part of the talk is the existence of a creator is obvious beyond rationality. Mm-hmm. And that creator, we know a couple things. Very smart and very powerful. But which God? Which God? Which God are we talking about? The Muslim God or the Christian God or some unknown God? All right? And so I want to talk about that a little bit, okay? Here's a statement by Dallas McCown, a well-known evolutionist and atheist. He said, Christianity is scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable, philosophically suspect at best, disreputable at worst, and historically fraudulent. Now, let's stop right there. You know, these scholars, these very smart people make statements like this, but this is nonsense. This is nonsense. All right, so you're saying the Bible's full of historical errors and fables and stuff. My response to that is, well, can you give me a single example? Let me share a story. I was in a van with a bunch of science professors. We were going between venues at a conference. And this one lady said, Christianity, Stupid religion.
No.
Notice this. She's in with about 7 or 8 science professors, assuming she could have this conversation. Obviously. See, seriously. I think part of the problem is we believers don't stand up for belief. We kind of are quiet in these situations. I'll tell you, I was not, okay? So she said, yeah, the Bible's really stupid. The Old Testament, it teaches that if you wear clothing with one more than one material, capital punishment. What a stupid religion. So I said, excuse me, but the Bible doesn't teach that. She says, oh, yes, it did. Yes, it does. I saw it on a website. And I said to her, you know what? People say the Bible is full of all kinds of science errors. I said, I've read it through at least 6 times. I haven't found one yet. I don't know what they're talking about. And then I pulled out my Bible. Can you imagine? Now, you Christian believer, could you find that verse?
That's a tough one to find. The one in Leviticus that talks about. I was my original Bible that I got when I became a Christian. I knew it was on the right-hand side about a third of the way down. I said a quick prayer and I found it.
By the way, that's not what the Bible teaches. And I tell you that story to illustrate the point, which is don't be afraid of bald people with glasses who act smart, okay? Don't be afraid of these people, okay? They're working in a belief system that doesn't make sense. All right, philosophically suspect. I would compare Christian philosophy to atheist philosophy any day. That's a whole other talk. All right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about some evidence, even from a scientific perspective, that seems to make belief in the Bible reasonable, and therefore I conclude which God, even from science, never mind all the other evidence, which God, the God of the Bible. Now, the Bible is not a science book. The way Galileo put it, he says, the Bible is written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. That's a pretty smart statement. It's not a science book. And so, for example, I don't read Genesis as a science text per se. It's basically the Bible is a God book. It's not a science book. But I'll say this. Every single time the Bible makes definite statements that relate to things we know from science, it's not in error. Now, this is the Papyrus Ebers. It's a couple pages of it. It's the PDR of Egypt, the Physician's Death Reference of Egypt. And scholars of medical history will tell you that the two ancient cultures that had the greatest knowledge in medical areas were probably the Egyptians and the Chinese. It's significant that this document comes from roughly 1500 BC, which happens to be when Moses was kind of walking around. All right?
My point is going to be this. We're going to look at some prescriptions in this document. My point is going to be this. If the Bible is what these people are saying it is, which is a book written by ignorant people in an ignorant age, using their wisdom, then the Bible would have things like what we're about to see that come from the Papyrus Hebrews. Right, to prevent hair from turning gray, anointed with the blood of a calf, which is boiled in oil, or with the fat of a rattlesnake. Marty? All right. How about a mixture of 6 facts, namely those of the horse, the hippopotamus, the crocodile, the cat, the snake, the ibex, to prevent hair loss?
Now, clearly, I ought to probably get busy with that. All right? I think the idea was they wanted to make the women sort of be more attractive to them. I don't know. If somebody's wearing that stuff, ladies, what do you think? All right. Now, let's look at some of the other prescriptions that were used to heal diseases found in Papyrus Ebers. Lizard's blood, swine's teeth, putrid meat. There's some nice medicine right there. Moisture from pig's ears. This is, I'm not making this up.
And human excrement as medicine. Human excrement. Now, we're laughing, and it's kind of humorous, but actually, it's not really humorous at all. In fact, it is tragic. Average lifespan, 20-25 years. Not that people couldn't live to be 90, they could live to be 90, but almost all of them were taken down by an infectious disease of one sort or another. Okay?
Now, I'm going to say that the Bible does not contain anything even remotely like this. The Bible has a lot of medical advice, actually, more than you think.
Now, here's an interesting verse. It's in Exodus 15. God says to his people, if you obey the laws I'm giving you today, you will not have the diseases of your neighbors.
How many ancient cultures, how many cultures have a continuous existence of over 3,000 years?
The Indian culture, the Chinese culture, Egyptian culture,
and the Jews.
They don't seem to fit in very well with that list. Excuse me for saying that. You know, didn't have a particular homeland. They were just trying to wipe them out again and again.
Yeah, tough, tough history. I believe one of the reasons the Jews have survived is because when they obeyed God's laws, they lived longer. They had more children. All right? So I'm going to show you a few examples. For example, in Leviticus 11, you can read it. All of us are aware that certain meats were allowed and certain were not. All right, for example, pig, yes. Pig, no, rather. I'm sorry. Beef, yes. Pig, no. Lamb, yes. Predators, no. Fish with scales, yes. Shellfish, no. It just so happens that every meat on the okay to eat list is relatively safe, and every meat on the don't eat list is relatively dangerous. Let's talk about pork. 22 known diseases. Trichinosis for one.
Pork.
Now, with modern health practices, I still say cook your pork all the way through, right?
Yes.
But beef, even rare, is relatively safe. I was in Venezuela a few years ago, and I speak Spanish okay, but I didn't know what was on the menu. So I said, bring me one of those. Okay, bring me one of those. Nice big plate of raw beef. And I'm thinking, okay, Leviticus 11. Bible said fish with scales, yes. Shellfish of every sort, no. The fact is, shellfish of every sort is relatively dangerous. Now, I grew up in Connecticut. We were clams and stuff like that. It's a great idea. All right, now, I can think of two possible arguments here. One, Moses was lucky. Or two, that he had access to special knowledge. Because here's the fact. All the peoples around them ate all these foods and died in great numbers compared to the Jews. So there's one example. Now, in case you thought, well, maybe somehow the Jews, they were just good in this area or something like that. Here is a Jewish document from ancient times with advice on medical things. Showing, again, how the biblical statements are radically different. Let's look at the second one. The gnat, feeble creature, taking in food but never secreting it. Wait a minute, let's stop there. What this is saying is flies don't have poop. Is that true? No, that's wrong. That's a science error. The Bible has none. And I challenge anybody to show me an exception. If you know one, ask a question about it. We could talk about it. All right, secreting it is a specific against the blood poison of the viper. So I guess they had to keep a jar of flies available because when you get bitten by the snake, what are you going to do, catch a bunch of gnats there? I don't think that would work very well. All right, here's another one. Whoever touches the dead body of anyone will be unclean for 7 days. Must first purify himself with the water of the third and seventh day, take some hyssop, dip it in the water, sprinkle his tent with the furnishings, and the people were there. This seems like kind of a harsh decree. So what you're saying is, if you help prepare the body for the funeral, you have to be separate from the people for 7 days. What's that about? What's that about? All right, well, this is Ignaz Semmelweis. He's from Budapest. I made the mistake a few years ago. I was teaching in Budapest, and I said he was from Serbia. Oh. And they said, no, he's from Budapest. I said, okay, I heard he's from Serbia. And then they took me to his house. Sorry, my bad. But anyway, he's working in a hospital in Vienna, and the death rate in this hospital, the women's hospital, was 18%. Back then, people had the doctor to their home for their birth, not because they couldn't afford to go to the hospital,
but because they couldn't afford to not go to the hospital. They were death traps. It was called puerperal fever. Doctors had many different explanations. They said it was something in the air. They said it was the alignment of the planets. They said that women were just hysterical. A typical male attitude there.
All right. By the way, God didn't say why you shouldn't touch a dead body. He just said, don't touch a dead body. I learned something from this.
If God tells you to do something, even if you don't know why, just do it. If God says to not do something, even if you don't know why, just don't do it. So anyway, so in his hospital, what he noticed is the doctors would examine the bodies of the women that had died of puerperal fever the day before it, in the beginning of their rounds, and they'd go up and examine the women. And we cringe at that thought, right? Because germ theory had not been discovered at this point. Now, God could have said, don't touch dead bodies because of the germs, and they didn't have a word for that, all right? So he just said, don't touch dead bodies. Anyway, so he said, from now on, whenever you examine a dead body, you have to thoroughly clean your hands with soap and water because you're unclean. The death rate went down to 4%. And then he said, actually, you know what? Even when you touch a living patient, wash your hands with soap and water. Now, in Leviticus, it says, when a woman gives birth, she's unclean for 7 days. Has to be separate for 7 days. Why is that? Well, everybody knows God hates women. You know, it's so no, God loves women. And when are women most susceptible to infection? When do you think? So anyway, some of us says, whenever you touch a woman, in a sense, you're unclean in the sense you have to wash your hands with soap and water. The death rate went down to half of 1%. They should have had a marching band parade through the streets of Vienna.
Instead, the doctors fired him, and a few months later, he died of an infection, which is pretty sad. All right? Now, this is a point to add. Oops, I don't know why that's in there. I don't know if somebody's tech person. There's the tech guy.
By the way, I always want to give a shout out to the tech guys because you never notice them until something goes wrong, right? Now, I teach organic chemistry. All right. Anybody taking organic chemistry?
I have.
All right. What do we call that kind of molecule? We call it a phenol. I'll just help you. It's a phenol. Phenol, very good, phenol.
Now, when I teach phenols, the first property I tell my students is this.
Phenols are compounds which are not poisonous to humans, but kill bacteria. So, the recipe that God said when you touch a dead body, that Moses said, but I believe God said, Moses said, is you mix ashes with water and hyssop. Hyssop is a very, very oily plant. You crush it up. The oil from the hyssop with the ash and the water makes soap. But this particular plant has 10% of thymol in its oil. In other words, God's prescription was to use a powerful antibacterial soap. Whenever you touch a dead body, it washed your entire body and everything you touched. And people say, a book written by an ignorant people in an ignorant age. I don't know about that. Here's another one, Leviticus 13:46. Probably you're aware of this one. Certain skin diseases, they were told, if you have this skin disease, you are separate from the people completely until all signs of that disease are gone. Again, very harsh. Cruel. And you know, there's even here, you know, stories about it, of the cruelty of this kind of treatment. Okay, fine.
Did you know that leprosy was the most feared disease in the ancient world? Mm-hmm. Not because it killed the most people. No. Cholera killed more people. Malaria killed more people. But it's the horrible way that it kills people.
Again, the medical science said it's from the alignment of the planets and from eating hot food or something like that, whatever. There are many possible answers. The Bible simply said, look, quarantine. Now, in the 1600s in Scandinavia, there were some monks that were working in a hospital, and they made this simple proposal.
when people get leprosy, quarantine. And within three generations, leprosy had virtually disappeared in Europe. So again, we see biblical wisdom here. Here's another one, Leviticus 17:14.
Says the life of every creature is in its blood. That's why I said to the Israelites, you must not eat the blood of any creature, because the life of every creature is in its blood. Anyone who eats it must be cut off. Now, another point to make is, each one of these teachings, God didn't say why, number one. Number two, it had medical implications, but number three, it had a spiritual meaning as well. God can combine all three simultaneously. If you understand the New Testament, the life of every creature is in its blood. And how about touching the unclean? And every single one of these had a spiritual meaning as well. Now, do you know what the most common treatment for infectious disease was in the Western world in the 1700s, 1800s?
Bloodletting.
Because medical theory said that if you have an infectious disease, the disease is in the blood. Which makes sense. That would explain how it passes through the body. It makes sense. It's utter nonsense, but it makes sense. So the Bible said the life is in the blood. Medical science said the disease is in the blood. Who was right?
Well, the life is in the blood. Because if you have an infectious disease, where's the immune system found? It's found in the blood. These are some instruments that were used. You know the barbershop pole, the red and white striping?
Yeah.
Because you went to the barber to get the bloodletting.
That was
yes, the surgeon. All right, one more example. By the way, these are not the only examples. These are just a few examples. All right, this one is pre-Leviticus. This goes all the way back to the book of Genesis. For the generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised. You're aware of that. Male circumcision. Ouch! And by the way, that is dangerous. Although death is quite unusual, it is possible for that to bring about death. So, two questions. Number one, why circumcision? Mm-hmm. And number two, why on the eighth day? And again, the Bible doesn't say. That's the pattern here.
Now, let me suggest why circumcision. Now, let's think about it. Almost everybody died from either bacteria or some kind of a fungus.
And all these bacteria and fungus, they grow wherever it's dark, warm, and wet. Well, where's the darkest, warmest, wettest place on a guy? Especially if the foreskin is still there. Okay? And whose lives were saved? Principally, women's lives were saved. Principally. And men as well. A number of studies have shown, and it was controversial at first, but it's been consistent. Study after study have shown. For example, in the case of AIDS, the spread of AIDS drops 60% simply by male circumcision. So that across southern Africa, massive male, adult male circumcision are being done today to prevent the spread of AIDS. You know what? I have a better way to prevent the spread of AIDS. Obey the Bible. Now, by the way, in my opinion, I'm not a doctor. In my opinion, in our setting, the medical necessity of circumcision is relatively small. Hopefully you guys can shout, okay? Nevertheless. Now, but why on the eighth day? Again, I don't know why on the eighth day, but the third day would make sense, because for the Jews, the number three kind of had a special meaning. The 12th day, that would have made sense. The whole number 12, why the 8th day? I know of no meaning from a numerology perspective for the 8th day. I don't know why, but I think I do know why, but the Bible doesn't say why. Now you can see two words up there, vitamin K and prothrombin. Turns out vitamin K does not pass from mother to child. It does not go through the placenta. And without vitamin K, we don't produce prothrombin. Prothrombin is the actual protein that makes the blood clot. So if you were to circumcise a child on the first day, there's a high chance they would bleed out. Not good. Actually, the child is born with a low level of prothrombin because that protein does pass to the child. So then the level actually drops
because they have no vitamin K. So where's the vitamin K come from? Baby eats from mommy, gets lots of awesome bacteria. The bacteria go to the large intestine. The baby starts to produce prothrombin. Then what happens is the prothrombin level goes up to unnaturally high levels, and then it drops down to normal levels. So I'm going to show you a graph, which is going to be natural level of prothrombin in the male child versus number of days after birth. And guess what the safest day, from the day the male child is born to the day the male child dies, what's the safest day to do a male circumcision?
Number eight.
By the way, the ninth day is just as good. I mean, the seventh day is just as good. All right? You could argue for just luck. I mean, how did Abraham know this?
Well, maybe what he did was he did a double-blind experiment. The next 5 years, we're going to circumcise them all on the first day, and then the next 5 years on the third day, etc. I don't think that's what it was. Okay? And by the way, I believe the Bible's inspired by God. You might have noticed, I believe that. But I believe it. The science evidence is this much compared to, you know, this much. In fact, I want to invite you. Is it okay if I invite people?
Yes.
I'm going to invite you Sunday morning to Jaime Arjona at 10 o'clock. And there I get to talk about the stuff I really like talking about, which is other evidence for the inspiration of the Bible, such as messianic prophecies, fulfilled types, prefigures, historical accuracy, and all these other things. All right, so anyway, we're going to take, are we going to do an open question and answer? That's what I prefer.
Yeah.
Or we could take written down questions.
We have 20 minutes.
Right? All right, we have 20 minutes, so let's just get started. Any questions related to this talk, directly or indirectly? I didn't talk about evolution. I didn't talk about Genesis. A lot of things I didn't talk about. Yes?
How long did it take you to get all this research? What did you use for research?
Just material I use for teaching in undergraduate classes. And I was aware of most of this material before I became a Christian. Like I said, for example, the 60 zeros and a 1, I was not aware of that before I became a Christian. But the stuff about the elements and the stuff about water and all those, I was. And that's part of why, again, I came to believe in God because of that. I didn't become a Christian because of that. I came to believe in God because of that. Marty could probably even remember when I started becoming religious in my junior year in college. He probably remembers that. But it was when I read the Bible and saw that as a unique book. That's when I became a Christian. So it was evidence from the Bible itself, Jesus' resurrection, that I became a Christian. But I came to believe in God because of these things. It's not as if these are not unknown facts. Far from it. Okay, there's a question up here. Okay.
So yeah, so you learn this through your undergraduate studies. You kind of end up learning all this stuff and becoming a believer in God just by
right.
Seeing this. Wow, it changed your view.
Yeah. Wow. Again, like I said, I don't know how people can maintain the lack of design view. In light of what we know, I seriously wonder how they stick to that. It boggles the mind. It really does. All right. I'll take a question here.
Well, something I've heard back from an atheist perspective is that our planet, you know, is super unique compared to, like, the how many numbers of planets are out there, and that it could have just worked out that planet happened to have all those features. I know you explained it away there, but what do you say to something of that nature? How do you develop that?
So our planet had information? Yeah. See, how did the information get here? Let's just say there's a low probability or something like that, and the Earth is somewhat unique. But what's that have to do with the argument about iron? What's that have to do with the argument? That's you're ignoring the question. Because what we're saying here is, if it were not for the fact that at least one element is indeed magnetic, and number two, it had to be much more stable than all the other elements. If those two combined facts, without both of those facts, we wouldn't be here. What's that have to do with anything? That argument is irrelevant. Now, it is true that in order for life to exist, you need a planet that of the right temperature.
and that has a lot of water, and you could argue that that's a relative, that would be a relatively rare thing in the universe, but to be honest with you, probably there are many planets that are circling a sun that is of the right size, that are the right distance and all that kind of stuff, because the bottom line is the universe God created creates a planet like that naturally. Now, there's a few things that are quite unique about the Earth that may be evidence, maybe a supernatural thing. To me, life was supernatural, but the creation, its event was supernatural. But then the evolution of the universe seems to have occurred by natural processes. However, the moon, and scientists have no idea how the heck we got such a big moon, and because all the physics equations make it seem extremely unlikely. And the huge moon has the effect of stabilizing the Earth's orbit. And without the stability of the Earth's orbit, life could have existed on the Earth, but the kind of evolution that's happened over time seems extremely unlikely. That's, you know, anyway. Yeah?
I was going to say, is there a way you just found all this out through your own research?
All scientists know, everything I'm saying is common knowledge to anybody who's a scientist. But every single thing I presented here is common knowledge to all scientists.
But that's just a fact. I mean, like, so
right, then you come to this presentation, I give it to you, and now you know it too.
Okay.
All right, yes.
All right, so I'll probably in the minority, but do you argue for how science and theology can have this compatibility, right?
Yeah.
I'm a little late to the presentation, so I'm sorry.
That's fine.
So how can you explain kind of the fundamental principles of science, such as, or codes of conduct, like falsifiability and skepticism,
yeah,
the term of skepticism, things like these that can't really be used when you think about theology and literature.
Right, right. So what he's referring to is one of the demarcations of science from non-science, as Karl Popper, the philosopher, said, is falsifiability. All right, so a theory, almost by definition, cannot be scientific if it's not falsifiable by experiment, which I certainly agree with that. And that's why, for example, I believe design, the idea of design is not a scientific idea. It's not. I believe in design, but it's not scientific. The reason it's not scientific, number one, is because it can't be tested by experiment, and it can't be falsifiable by experiment. So therefore, design is not a scientific concept. Which is why I believe, because, you know, I assume you're aware of the intelligent design movement that are trying to kind of push design into science courses, and I resist that. I don't think they should do that. It doesn't make sense. However, design is real. Carl Sagan, who's an atheist, he produced the movie Contact. And basically, it's about the SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And so this signal came in that was a list of prime numbers. And when they saw that list of prime numbers, they knew it was intelligence. Now, that's not a falsifiable thing. And the idea of design is not falsifiable. The idea of design is not scientific, but it's certainly real. And the evidence for it is overwhelming. But it's just not a scientific question. The question of design is not a scientific one. It's an intellectual one. It's a philosophical one. But it's not a scientific one. Which is why I argue that, although I respect these Christians who are trying to kind of, I respect their intent, I disagree with their attempts to push design into scientific curriculum. I don't know, you didn't ask a question more like you made a comment you wanted me to reflect on. So, did I reflect on that in a helpful way or not? Or?
I think it was unclear about the parameters of the discussion.
All right.
I did it right away. Is that the basis of your discussion?
But I argue that the only rational view of the universe that we actually live in is that it was designed. Right. And I think I created a fairly strong case. But if you're not convinced, fine. I mean, that's fine. It's not my job to convince people of that, okay? Go ahead and ask another question in a minute, but let's take it. Was there a question there? All right, I'll take one from here then.
Astrology
or astronomy?
Astrology.
Astrology, okay.
I'm not sure what's up with the stars and stuff.
Right.
And
basic premise of astrology is that the position of the planets in the zodiac has an influence on us as human beings. Right. I've never seen any evidence that that's true. Certainly science doesn't acknowledge that. If you found that to be true, I don't know what to say. I would say this. Definitely, the Bible more than discourages, it outright condemns that viewpoint. All right, but then you're going to have to decide for yourself what's the evidence that supports this, okay? But the bottom line is, like it says in Romans, it was the verse that I mentioned I was going to read, but I never did. All right, the one in Romans. So, I'm going to just... That's for you to decide. I mean, you feel from your own personal experience that that believing in horoscopes and astrology has given you information that's reliable. I can't prove that wrong. It's not within my ability to prove that wrong. I would just say I certainly don't agree with that, but I respect your right to believe that. Now I'm gonna read. Basically, the idea that our calendars, the Jews use a lunar calendar. So God's saying one of the purposes, if you will, of the moon is to help us to count time or something like that. But he's certainly not encouraging astrology, that's for sure. Let me see, Romans chapter 1, he says, for although they knew neither knew God nor glorified him as God, nor gave thanks to him, they're thinking they can... futile. They claimed to be wise, but they became foolish. They exchanged the glory of God for images made to look like mortal men and birds and animals and reptiles. So basically it says that people began to worship created things rather than the Creator. And so as a Christian, I don't worship the stars or the moon or the sun because they're created. I'd rather worship the Creator of those things rather than those things. I believe they're created. In fact, scientific evidence says they're created. Scientific evidence says they're mere physical objects. And from the scientific perspective, the idea that they could influence us really is absurd. But, I'm not in a position to tell you that if you believe in that, you can't or something like that. All right, I'm going to take a question from over here.
Yeah, I agree with the design aspect of the universe, but my biggest sticking point or rationality is designer of the designer, or the designer of the designer.
So the classic question, and this is a question that, how can you not ask that question, right? If God created everything, who created God? And the answer that God gave is, I am. One thing we know. Things exist. I mean, if you want to deny that, okay, cool. and of course, we as human beings, we look for rational answers to that. All right, the Bible provides an answer to that, and we as individuals, I guess, get to decide for ourselves. Of course, one of the things God created was free will, so we could decide whether we believe that. But Jesus said, before Abraham was born, I am. So God, by definition, is that pre-existent thing, which is the reason that anything exists at all. Now, you could call that circular reasoning. I admit that. I'm not going to deny that, but I would just say the most rational explanation that I can see is a creator. And that creator, by definition, as even by God's very words to Moses, I am. Not I was, not I became, but I am. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. I'll take a question from back here.
There's a small question for the Father. And I'm going to use the example of throwing letters into the air.
All right.
Make a sense out of it. If we have the law of infinite probabilities, so...
Law of what?
Infinite probabilities.
All right, infinite. You mean infinitesimal or infinite?
So the fact that if you do something so many times, you eventually get the result you want.
Yeah.
So if you throw the letters into the air a million times, then don't you think eventually you will get a sentence made?
No, I don't. I don't. In fact, you wouldn't. Because information is not created spontaneously. This is the second law of thermodynamics. In my book, I talk about informational entropy, which is a special kind of entropy. And the simple answer, which probably deserves an explanation, simple answer is no, it doesn't happen. All right. For example, let's say the kids jump into the thing with the red and the green balls in McDonald's. Right? Right? Now, is it possible that if they do it long enough, all the green balls would be on one side and all the red balls would be on the other side? The answer is yes, it's possible, and you can calculate that possibility. The possibility is small enough, for example, that if you know all the McDonald's things for all time, if the universe has been around for 27 billion years, I mean, the chances are so small that you could argue it would be zero. But the thing is, in this case, we're not even talking about a random event. We're talking about the creation of information, intelligible information. And as far as I know, all scientific experiments so far have shown that that doesn't happen at all, period. In other words, the probability is literally zero. Now, scientists have tried to come up with this idea of natural selection of molecules, but when they try to set up models, it doesn't work. It appears to just not be true. Okay, so for example, you're saying, basically I'm translating your question to, isn't the same as the green balls all being on one side and the red balls all being on the other side? If you wait long enough, it'll happen. The answer is no. First of all, that would not happen in all history, no matter how. If you had, say, a million balls, the probability of 500,000 here and 100,000 being there is so many zeros, you know, time is not sufficient. But in this case, time doesn't help. Because what time does is it blows apart these molecules. That's a chemical fact. All right, so let's say you got a protein with 17 amino acids that actually has some information, which is not possible, but if it did, time breaks that molecule apart. It just does. So that argument falls apart for a couple of reasons, I believe. Okay, yes?
What is your take on evolution? I know there's been recent developments in the news on this, you know, on evolution. And
my take on evolution is, thank you, God, great plan. I mean, why Christians are defensive about evolution, it boggles my mind. But all I know is, the fact that it happens at all, it's amazing. It's amazing. The fact that genes exist, and that this thing can happen, that itself is truly amazing. And I don't want to say miraculous, because it is a natural process. It's almost, by definition, it's not miraculous. The Bible does not discuss evolution at all. All right? Let's talk about Genesis. Let's just kind of do an outline. So according to Genesis, first there was light, and then there was the earth, and there was water on the earth, and then land came up out of the water, and then life appeared in the water first, and that life changed the atmosphere, so then you could even see the sun and the stars, then life appeared on the land, and more complex life, and last of all, us. All right, so what's the problem with that? And in what sense, even conceivably, does that contradict the theory of evolution?
Monkeys.
Yeah, right. Specifically, having humans come from animals.
All right, yeah. The fact is, it is a reasonable scientific proposition that we have a common ancestor with apes. That is a reasonable scientific proposition. Okay? So, I just throw it out there. For example, let's talk about mammals that don't make vitamin C. Humans, chimpanzees, orangutans, gorillas, and guinea pigs. That's it. Now, clearly, the guinea pig, not vitamin C, is a different event. So clearly, there's a mutation event, because we have the oncogenes for vitamin C. We have the genes that make vitamin C, but in us, they don't make vitamin C because of a mutation. So therefore, the idea that we have a common ancestor is scientifically reasonable.
All right, now, I'm going to tell you this. But I got to finish answering the question, okay? I'm going to tell you this. I believe that God created Adam and Eve. Let me tell you why I believe it.
Because it says so in the Bible.
Okay? And that's one thing where I think some believers get themselves in trouble. Because they don't recognize that some things they believe because of the inspiration of the Bible, and that's established on certain evidence, and from other things they believe because of the evidence. Let me give an example. I believe the Bible is inspired by God because the evidence is totally overwhelming. Yep. I believe that life was created by God because the evidence is overwhelming. I believe that Jesus was raised from the dead because the evidence is overwhelming. I believe in a final resurrection, and there's no evidence for it whatsoever, and I believe it completely and only because it says so in the Bible. Right, and so I believe in Adam and Eve. I believe that story to be historical, and you want to know why? Because it says so in the Bible. All right. Now, you know, again, the Genesis story. I believe the Genesis story is true. In fact, the evidence is true because even when you look at science, it fits. It fits the information. If you look at the creation story of the Babylonians, the creation story of the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Iroquois, all these. Because all these cultures have creation stories, and they're kind of interesting stories. Let's just say interesting stories. And then the Bible creation story is the simplest of all, and it lines up with what we know. All right? But I'm going to tell you, I believe in Adam and Eve because of the Bible. Now, I believe there are things about us that are not explainable based on evolution. For example, the fact that we're conscious, the fact that we can understand the universe, the fact that we have a sense of morality. We know some things are right, some things are wrong. We believe in justice. All these things are evidence of the image of God. All right? Now, here, you're kind of on this gray area between science and religion. I talk about science and religion in my Science 110 class, and I tell students there's a range of questions that should be left that science should have first dibs on. And there's a range of questions, I believe, religion and philosophy should have first dibs on. And almost all questions very cleanly fall into one camp or the other. Evolution is one of those. The age of the earth, you know, does the earth move? These kinds of things. There's only a few questions where there's going to be some natural, possibly even conflict. Or one of the questions is, what is a person? All right, what is a person? Clearly, science will always attempt to answer that question, and clearly, religion will as well. All right, so let me throw out two possible statements about what is a person. For example, I have a body, or I am a body. Everybody knows the correct answer. We all know the correct answer, and yet the answer we know to be true does not come from science. A good friend of mine, Dr. John Beggs at the University of Indiana, he does a talk on a neuroscience, Room for the Soul. And he argues from neuroscience that the idea of a soul makes sense. But again, we're not going to prove soul from science. We're not going to prove consciousness from science. What Dawkins calls it is an epiphenomenon. But I'm telling you, I have a body. All right? In fact, if you take the atheist perspective, you shouldn't say to your significant other, I love you. You should say, I chemical you. I chemical you. Love is a meaningless word. I got off the subject. Sorry. 5 minutes, okay. You've been waiting for a while, go ahead.
How would you reconcile something like carbon dating and the fact that the Earth has been around for quite a while, as well as the universe? How would you reconcile that with the 7 days of creation in...
All right. I just did this yesterday. In my Science 110 class, I did that exact question in my Science 110 class yesterday. Now, first of all, like I told my students, carbon dating is completely irrelevant to the age of the Earth. And the reason is, carbon-14 has a half-life of only 5,700 years. So, as I told my students yesterday, uranium-lead dating or potassium-argon dating for geology and paleontology and the age of the Earth. Carbon dating is only useful for archaeology, for things that are a few thousand years old. So let's not worry about carbon dating. Well, let's just talk about the age of the Earth and Genesis.
Now, I believe that the time frame is a literary tool in Genesis 1. In fact, Philo, the Greek philosopher of the first century, believed that those days were metaphorical. They're not literal, in literally like 7 24-hour periods. All the great early Christian theologians thought the same thing, long before science even discovered the age of the earth. Origen, Augustine, they all believed that that story, although it was historically viable, they believed that the days were metaphorical. Mm-hmm. In other words, first God did this, then God did this, then God did this, and then God did this, etc. Alright, and so, but again, this is a matter of interpretation. And I admit there's more than one interpretation. So here's what I do with my students. I say, because I have a lot of young earthers in my class. I have a lot of them. So I say, what I'm going to do is, I'm going to defend young earth theory. Then I just literally walk over here and I say, alright, let's imagine that I'm a theologian right now. Alright, so I'm going to propose to you the existence of an omnipotent, omniscient, allos omni God. All right, and let's suppose, could that God create the universe appearing old at the moment of its creation? Could that God that I just proposed do that?
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
If so, then the earth would appear old. All right, so that's not a scientific idea. Please don't defend that idea as scientific. That is, I mean, as our friend up here would remind me, that's a so unscientific idea. That's a theological proposition. Now I'm going to come back over here, and I'm going to I actually debate myself in front of my students. I say, so, now wait a minute. I'm looking through a telescope at an object that's a billion light years away. So the light that's hitting my eye that came through the mirrors and the telescope, when did they leave that galaxy?
A
billion years ago. All right, but then you know. Basically, God could do whatever he wants. All right, fine. Now, I don't believe it. I don't believe the earth is young. And I certainly don't think that's the necessary interpretation of Genesis 1. In fact, I don't even think it's the most natural interpretation. To those who understand sort of the literary context of Genesis 1. So, all right, we used up our time.
One more.
Oh, one more. Okay, great. Here we go. Angels, dinosaurs, and dragons. Angels, dinosaurs, dragons. Okay. All right. Dragons. All right, here we go. Dragons. No. Dinosaurs, yes, but they went away 65 million years ago. And angels, that's not a scientific question. All right. Let's summarize. All right. Thank you very much. We're going to hang out, and you have some comments to make?
Yes, I do.
Great.
Thank you, John. That was great.
So there's a moment, probably I shared a moment with all of you guys where the information was like way over our head. Maybe some of you guys, it wasn't. You're just smarter than me. John said he wasn't a biology person. I studied biology, and I quickly found out that was not my path. So I'm very grateful for guys like John and our tech people. I'm sure Paul felt the most encouraged in his life, and everyone clapped for him. Thank you.
Once again, your response is very important to us. If you came in late and weren't able to get a response card, and you'd like one, please raise your hand. But on the response card, if you'd like to let us know what you thought, we want to know, because we want to do a similar event like this next semester. So we want to know what you think. But in addition to that, if you're interested in other Alpha Omega events, please check that box. If you're interested in attending church with the Source Church, please check that box. And if you're interested in personal Bible studies, please check that box as well. If you provide us with some form of contact information, we will reach out to you. So please, your response is important to us, and you can drop those off with the ushers at the door before you leave at some point. Okay, this is really cool. So tomorrow morning, Professor Oakes will be, wherever he is, where did you go? There he is. He will be taking personal appointments with anyone who would like to speak with him personally for a 30-minute block from 9 a.m. till 12:30. We have 6 sessions available. If you would like to do that, please see
one of the members of the Alpha Omega Christian Club, Mimo Mariyuki, if you can stand up so everyone knows who you are. Thank you. So if you would like to sign up for one of those blocks, please see Mimo, let her know your name, some form of contact information. Those sessions, those appointments will take place in the Student Union Food Court. John will be there. He's open to talking about whatever it is. So if you'd like one of those, please be one of the first to see her. We have 6 blocks available for that. In addition to that, as I've announced before, the Alpha Omega Christian Club is a part of the Storrs Church of Christ, and we have purchased a bunch of soccer tickets tomorrow night for the homecoming soccer game. So if you would like to join us, I have a good amount of them. First come, first serve. So if you come to me late, you're like, I want a soccer ticket. I'm going to say, buy one for a couple dollars at the box office. So if you would like one for free, you can come and see me. When I run out, I run out. I'm sorry. But on Sunday morning, Professor Oakes will also be speaking before the Storrs Church in Arjona, the Arjona Hall, the big lecture hall they have. If you would like to join us there, he'll be speaking more about science and faith as well. That will take place on Sunday morning at 10 in the Arjona Hall. And if you don't want to fill out a response card, but you're interested in coming to the Alpha Omega Christian Club's Bible Talk that we have on campus, that takes place in the Student Union in room 221. You're welcome to join us any Tuesday you like, and there is food. So once again, thank you for coming out. We really... Great question. It's at 7:30. On Tuesdays, Student Union, room 221. That's at 7:30 on Tuesday. It's a great discussion we have each week. Very practical and uplifting for our life. So, once again, thank you for coming out, all the students from UConn, but also thank you for all those who came in from all parts of New England to join us this evening. Thank you once again, John, for the seminar. And one more thing, if you would like to purchase one of his books, he has his book table right here, and if you would like to talk with him briefly after this discussion, he will be right here. And thank you so much.